short, my child. If you go to heaven without being naturally qualified for it, you'll not enjoy yourself there.
And who dares say that I am not naturally qualified for it? The most distinguished princes of the church have never questioned it. I owe it to myself to leave this place at once.
As you please, Signora. I should have expected better taste from you.
Father, I shall expect you to come with me. You cannot stay here. What will people say?
People? Why, all the best people are here. Princes of the church and all. So few go to heaven, and so many come here that the blessed, once called the heavenly host, are now a continually dwindling minority.
That is true. From the beginning of my career, I knew that I should win in the long run by sheer weight of public opinion. In spite of the long campaign of misrepresentation and calumny against me, at bottom the universe is a constitutional one, and with such a majority as mine, I cannot be kept permanently out of office.
I think, Anna, you had better stay here.
You do not want me to go with you.
Surely you do not want to enter heaven in the company of a reprobate like me.
All souls are equally precious. You repent, do you not?
My dear Anna, you are silly. You suppose that heaven is like earth, where people persuade themselves that what is done can be undone by repentance, that what is spoken can be unspoken by withdrawing it, that what is true can be annihilated by some general agreement to give it the lie? No. Heaven is the home of the masters of reality. That is why I'm going there.
Thank you. I am going to heaven for happiness. I have had quite enough of reality on earth.
Then you must stay here, for hell is the home of the unreal and of the seekers for happiness. It is the only refuge from heaven, which is, as I tell you, the home of the masters of reality, and from earth, which is the home of the slaves of reality. The earth is a nursery in which men and women play at being heroes and heroines, saints and sinners, but they are dragged down from their fool's paradise by their bodies. Hunger and cold and thirst, age and decay and disease, death above all, make them slaves of reality. 3 times a day, meals must be eaten and digested. 3 times a century, a new generation must be engendered. Ages of faith, of romance, and of science are all driven at last to have but one prayer. Make me a healthy animal. But here, you escape this tyranny of the flesh. For here, you're not an animal at all. You're a ghost. An appearance, an illusion, a convention. Deathless, ageless, in a word, bodiless. There are no social questions here. No political questions. No religious questions. Best of all, perhaps, no sanitary questions. Here, you call your appearance beauty, your emotions love, your aspirations virtue, just as you did on earth. But here, there are no hard facts to contradict you. No ironic contrast of your needs with your pretension. No human comedy. Nothing but a perpetual romance. A universal melodrama. And yet you want to leave this paradise.
But if hell be so beautiful as this, how glorious must heaven be?
Oh, no.
I beg your pardon. I am terribly sorry. I interrupted.
That's my fault.
You were going to say something?
No. After you, gentlemen.
You have been so eloquent on the advantages of my dominions that I leave you to do equal justice to the drawbacks of the alternative establishment.
In heaven, as I see it, my dear lady, you live and work instead of playing and pretending. You face things as they are. You escape nothing but glamour. And your steadfastness and your peril are your glory. If the play still goes on here and on earth, and all the world is a stage, heaven is at least behind the scenes. But heaven cannot be described by metaphor. There I shall go presently, because there I hope to escape at last from lies and from the tedious, vulgar pursuit of happiness, to spend my eons in contemplation. Commander, you know, I do not blame your disgust. A picture gallery is a dull place for a blind man. But even as you enjoy the contemplation of such romantic mirages as beauty and pleasure, so would I enjoy the contemplation of that which interests me above all things, namely life, The force that ever strives to attain greater power of contemplating itself. What made this brain of mine, do you think? Not the need to move my limbs, for a rat with half my brain is moved as well as I. Not merely the need to do, but the need to know what I do, lest in my blind efforts to live, I should be slaying myself.
You'd have slain yourself in your blind efforts to fence, my friend, but for my foot slipping.
Your laughter will finish in hideous boredom before morning.
Do you remember how I frightened you when I said something like that to you from my pedestal in Seville? Sounds rather flat without my trombones.
They tell me it generally sounds flat with them, Commander.
Do not interrupt with these frivolities, Father. Is there nothing in heaven but contemplation, Juan?
In the heaven I seek, no other joy, but there is the work of helping life in its struggle, upward. Think of how it wastes and scatters itself, how it raises up obstacles to itself and destroys itself in its ignorance and blindness. It needs a brain, this irresistible force, lest in its ignorance it should resist itself. What a piece of work is man, says the poet. Yes, but what a blunderer. There is the highest miracle of organization yet attained by life, the most intensely alive thing that exists, the most conscious of all the organisms, and yet how wretched are his brains.
Did I not say when I was arranging that affair of Faust's that all man's reason has done for him is to make him beastlier than any beast? One splendid body is worth the brains of 100 dyspeptic, flatulent philosophers.
You forget that magnificence of body without brain has been tried. Things immeasurably greater on man in every respect but brains have existed and perished. The Megatherium, the Ichthyosaurus, have paced the earth with 7-league steps and hidden the day with cloud-vast wings. Where are they now? Fossils in museums, and so few and imperfect at that, that a knuckle, bone, or a tooth from one of them is prized beyond the lives of 1,000 soldiers. These things lived and wanted to live, but for lack of brains, they did not know how to carry out their purpose, and so destroyed themselves.
And is man any the less destroying himself for all this boasted brain of his? Or have you walked up and down upon the earth lately? I have. And I have examined man's wonderful inventions. And I tell you that in the arts of life, man invents nothing. But in the arts of death, he outdoes nature herself and produces by chemistry and machinery all the slaughter of plague, pestilence, and famine. For the peasant I tempt today eats and drinks what was eaten and drunk by the peasants of 10,000 years ago. And the house he lives in is not altered as much in 1,000 centuries as the fashion of a lady's bonnet in 100 weeks. But when he goes out to slay, he carries a marvel of mechanism that lets loose at the touch of his finger all the hidden molecular energies and leaves the javelin, the arrow, the blowpipe of his fathers far behind. In the arts of peace, man is a bungler. I have seen his cotton factories and the like with machinery that a greedy dog could have invented if it had wanted money instead of food. I know his clumsy typewriters and bungling locomotives and tedious bicycles. They are toys compared to the machine gun, submarine torpedo boat. There is nothing in man's industrial machinery but his greed and sloth, his heart. In his weapons. This marvelous force of life of which you boast is a force of death. Man measures his strength by his destructiveness. What is his religion? An excuse for hating me. What is his law? An excuse for hanging you. What is his morality? Gentility. An excuse for consuming without producing. What is his art? An excuse for gloating over pictures of slaughter. What are his politics? Either the worship of a despot because a despot can kill, or parliamentary cockfighting. I spent an evening lately in a certain celebrated legislature and heard the pot lecturing the kettle for its blackness and politicians answering questions. When I left, I chalked up in the door the old nursery saying, ask no questions and you will be told no lies. I bought a family magazine and found it full of pictures of young men shooting and stabbing one another. Oh. I saw a man die. He was a London bricklayer's laborer with seven children. He left £17 insurance money. And his wife spent it all on his funeral and went into the poorhouse with the children the next day. She would not have spent 7 pence on her children's schooling. The law had to force her to let them be taught gratuitously, but on death, she spent all she had. Their imagination glows. Their energies rise up at the idea of death. These people, they love it. The more horrible it is, the more they enjoy it. Hell is a place far above their comprehension. They derive their notions of hell from two of the greatest fools that ever lived. An Italian and an Englishman. The Italian described it as a place of mud, frost, fire, filth, and venomous serpents. All torture. This ass, when he was not lying about me, was maundering about some woman he saw once in the street. The Englishman described me as being expelled from heaven with cannons and gunpowder. And to this day, everybody believes that the whole of his silly stories in the Bible. What else he says, I do not know, for the whole of it's in a long poem which neither I nor anyone else ever succeeded in wading through. It's the same in everything. The highest form of literature is the tragedy, the play in which everybody's murdered at the end. In the old chronicles, you read of earthquakes and pestilences and are told that these show the power and majesty of God and the littleness of man. You know, nowadays, the chronicles describe battles. In a battle, two bodies of men shoot at one another with bullets and explosive shells until one body runs away when the others chase the fugitives and cut them to pieces as they fly. And this, the chronicle concludes, shows the greatness and majesty of empires and the littleness of the vanquished. Over such battles, the people run about the streets, yelling with delight, and egg their governments on to spend hundreds of millions of money in the slaughter, whilst the strongest politicians dare not spend an extra penny in the pound against the poverty and pestilence through which they themselves daily walk away. I give you 1,000 instances, but they all come to the same thing. The power which governs the earth is not the power of life, but of death. And the inner need, which has nerved life into the effort of organizing itself into the human being, is not the need for higher life, but for a more efficient engine of destruction. The plague, the famine, the earthquake, the tempest were too spasmodic in their action. The tiger and crocodile, too easily satiated, not cruel enough. Something more constantly, more ruthlessly, more ingeniously destructive was needed. And that something was man. The inventor of the rack, the stake, the gallows, the electric chair, of sword and gun and poison gas, above all of justice, duty, patriotism, and all the other isms by which even those who are clever enough to be humanely disposed are persuaded to become the most destructive of all the destroyers.
All this is old. Your weak side, my diabolic friend, is that you have always been a dupe. You take man at his own valuation. Nothing would flatter him more than your opinion of him. He loves to think of himself as bold and bad. He's neither one nor the other. He's only a coward. Call him tyrant, murderer, pirate, bully. He will adore you and swagger about with the consciousness of having the blood of the old sea kings in his veins. Call him liar and thief. He will only take an action against you for libel. But call him coward. Oh, he will go mad with rage. He will face death to outface that stinging truth. Man gives every reason for his conduct, save one. Every excuse for his crimes, save one. Every plea for his safety, save one, and that one is cowardice. Yet, all his civilization is founded on his cowardice, on his abject dameness, which he calls his respectability. There are limits to what a mule or an ass will stand, but man will suffer himself to be degraded until his vileness becomes so loathsome to his oppressors that they themselves are forced to reform it.
Precisely! And these are the creatures in whom you discover what you call a life force.
Yes, for now comes the most surprising part of the whole business.
What's that?
That you can make any of these cowards brave by simply putting an idea into his head.
Stop. Oh, as an old soldier, I admit the cowardice. It is universal as seasickness and matters just as little. But all that about putting an idea into a man's head. Stop nonsense. All you need in a battle to make you fight is a little hot blood. And the knowledge that it's more dangerous to lose than to win.
That is perhaps why battles are so useless. But men never really overcome fear until they imagine they are fighting to further a universal purpose. Fighting for an idea, as they call it. Why was the crusader braver than the pirate? Because he fought not for himself, but for the cross. What force was it that made him, with a valor as reckless as his own, the force of men who fought not for themselves, but for Islam? They took Spain from us, though we were fighting for our very horse and homes. But when we, too, fought for that mighty idea, a Catholic Church, we swept them back to Africa.
What, you a Catholic, Senor Don Juan, a devotee? My congratulations.
Come. As a soldier, I can listen to nothing against the church.
Have no fear, Commander. This idea of a Catholic church will survive Islam, will survive the cross, will survive even that vulgar pageant of incompetent schoolboyish gladiators that you call the army.
Yeah? Don, you will force me to call you to account for this.
Useless. You know I cannot fence. Every idea for which man will die will be a Catholic idea. When the Spaniard learns at last that he is no better than the Saracen, and his prophet no better than Muhammad, he will arise more Catholic than ever, and die on a barricade across the filthy slum he starves in for universal liberty and equality.
Bosh.
What you call bosh is the only thing man dare die for. Later on, liberty will not be Catholic enough. Men will die for human perfection, to which they will sacrifice all their liberty, gladly.
Oh, yes, they'll never be at a loss for an excuse for killing one another.
What of that? It is not death that matters, but the fear of death. It is not killing and dying that degrades us, but base living and accepting the wages and profits of degradation. Better 10 dead men than one live slave or his master. Yes, man shall still rise up. Father against son and brother against brother, and kill one another for the great Catholic idea of abolishing slavery.
Yes, when the liberty and equality of which you prate shall have made free white Christians cheaper in the labor market than black heathen slaves sold by auction at the block.
Oh, never fear. The white laborer shall have his turn, too. But I am not now defending the illusory form. The great idea at stake. I am giving you examples of the fact that this creature, man, who in his own selfish affairs is a coward to the backbone, will fight for an idea like a hero. He may be abject as a citizen, but he is dangerous as a fanatic. He can only be enslaved while he is spiritually weak enough to listen to reason. I tell you, gentlemen, if you can show a man a piece of what he now calls God's work to do, and what you will, later on, call by many new names, you can make him entirely reckless of the consequences to himself personally.
Yes, he shirks all his responsibilities and leaves his wife to grapple with them.
Well said, daughter. Don't you let him talk you out of your common sense.
Alas, Senor Commander, now that we have got onto the subject of woman, he will talk more than ever. However, I confess it is for me the one supremely interesting subject.